This is Gaten the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it.
Welcome back to Gaten the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in today's episode, we are taking quite an interesting step on the podcast as we are finally looking into the Monogatari series. I haven't started the arc analyses yet, but that will be very soon, hopefully in the next few weeks. But I wanted to finally get the ball rolling and finally start discussing one of my favorite series of all time, being Nisio Isin's Monogatari series, and more specifically the anime adaptation of that. In today's episode, I want to specifically talk about Kizu Monogatari, and specifically the idea of the sort of cinema of humanity, as I named this episode. And so I want to talk about how Kizu Monogatari discusses humanity and kind of plays with this idea of it, as well as this notion of how it manages to challenge our idea of humanity and even make us question what humanity really is as we progress through this movie trilogy. The space and aspect ratios episode was basically me trying to lean into it, but it wasn't really the best attempt at leaning into it, but it still was a very good episode and it also did very well too. Thank you very much for that. And so this will be a bit more in the context of Monogatari. I'm not going to talk everything aesthetic, as there are many other things I want to talk about today, and then probably won't be much aspect ratio discussion. But as we do get through our discussion of the Monogatari series, I do want to mention a lot of other things, including the aesthetic, and really dive and break that apart and really see what makes it up. But for now, let's get to the episode for this week. That is episode 68 of Gaten the Mecha, Kizu Monogatari and the Cinema of Humanity. It is another episode of Gaten the Mecha, and what that means is that there will probably be spoilers in this episode, and like always, every episode I give you my alerts before I dive into the analysis so you get a good idea as to what I'm speaking about specifically. And in this episode there should be some light spoilers for the Kizu Monogatari trilogy of the Monogatari series by Nisio Isin. I am talking very specifically about the movie adaptation. I actually haven't read the light novels by Isin. And so this is very related to film and cinema and those techniques. And hence, listen at your own risk. However, I am still obviously going to be discussing the film and some of its contents, because it would be kind of impossible to do so. Talk about a film without actually talking about the film itself. And so there will be spoilers for the Kizu Monogatari trilogy within the Monogatari series. As I managed to mention in the intro, the Monogatari series is one of my favorite anime ever of all time, in the same realm as Marge Comes in Like a Lion and Mind Game, and of course Neon Genesis Evangelion. But more specifically, in something that I'm very passionate about when it comes to this show or anime, is the production side of it. I'm very passionate about this part too, and its aesthetic and Oishi and Shinbo's way of attacking the abstract ideas that are so unique to this series, and all these other layers which Isin manages to tackle within the books as well. Everything from the Japanese wordplay, and all these extra layers which they managed to add on top of this as well, so like the surrealist and postmodern element. A lot of things, basically, that I want to not necessarily all discuss in this episode, but it's good to acknowledge that these are things, I think, which make the Kizu Monogatari trilogy, as well as the Monogatari series, the series it is. I've seen nothing like it that manages to just take a completely, or at least relative to what I've seen, it just takes a completely different approach to filmmaking. And yeah, it's so memorable for me because of how it looks and how it manages to present itself. I like to think of the Oishi Jumbo combination kind of like an onion, in terms of you peel back one layer of when you are trying to understand how they attack filmmaking and how they attack this trilogy of films. And then you realize that there's another layer once you peel back the first one, and then there's another, and then there's another, until you get to the very core. But the thing about this analogy, which is quite interesting, is that I wouldn't say that there is a direct core, as that core is very blurred, which we'll explore today. I want to begin with something that's a bit more general that will underpin most of our analysis, even if it's not explicitly, and that is this idea of humanity, this notion of humanity. Humanity taps into almost every element of this series, and it's there from beginning to end. It influences a lot of the further themes to come into this show. And once we gain a grasp of this, I think understanding, or at least appreciating, Isin's writing and Oishi's influence and Shimbo's directing alongside his students becomes a lot easier, and one's eyes, I think, can open a lot more and can really get where they're coming from when you understand filmmaking through the lens of humanity. And so now, with all that kerfuffling and context out of the way, let's actually get into the quote-unquote cinema of humanity. What I really love as we enter Tekketsu, the first film of the trilogy, if we're to view this as the sort of prologue or the genuine prologue in the chronological standpoint, so it's not necessarily where you should watch it. You shouldn't necessarily watch Tekketsu as the first thing within the entirety of the Monogatari series, but whether you're to watch it in quote-unquote light novel order or within release order as I did, we're still very able to tell that this is the beginning. This is Araragi's first encounter with Shinobu. But even prior to that, within the film, it starts off with some very basic contradictions. The biggest one, and the one which really kicks off the Monogatari series, is the contradiction between his human element, or at least him as a human, versus his vampiric nature. It's made very obvious, and it's visually shown to us by the consequences of being a half-vampire within the sun. And thank you to Genichiro Abe for making this as, I don't know if we can use the term visceral, at least very in your face as possible. The way Genichiro Abe manages to animate fire, it just really takes us back. It's one of the most famous cuts within Tekketsu. It's the opening where Araragi's hand catches fire and he's melted and sweltering because of it. We also get introduced in the opening of the film to these other elements of Araragi, such as his more tempted side, so the very hedonistic element as he walks into the bookstore to get a very suspicious book, as I'll phrase it like that. And then as we progress, the other sort of, I want to say primitive side of Araragi being the fearful version of him when we have Yuyageshi's moment within the train station scene, where he's running away from Shinobu at first glance. It's the flight response, and Geshi animates with all these crazy thick lines to show Araragi running. It's also like the Koyoshinari stuff as well, towards the third movie as well, but if we focus on the first and the opening moments of the entire series within Tekketsu, these are probably the main things to pin down. This is where we really start to gain some insight into the, what I would say, the human condition. This comes from the part of the human condition being emotion. What does it mean to emote as a human? And emotion is a part of being human, as it being within the human condition would imply. But we managed to get a look into what it means to emote and how these are expressed. Araragi expresses pleasure and excitement as an emotion through watching or reading suspicious magazines, and then he expresses fear in the very extreme scenarios when he's running from a literal legendary vampire who isn't even chasing him. And already we can see there's this dualistic thing that manages to form, but it only develops further on as we get in. These do sound like binaries, and they do sound like complete opposites, but I would also challenge that by suggesting that this is how we spot the human condition, this is how we spot this subtext of humanity, as we need to see humanity as it's in its very basic forms in order to suss it out. Understanding humanity within Kizumonogatari is facilitated by its aesthetic as well, and this is something continuous to the series and something I want to try and dive into and figure out a bit more, because I am still very half-half on it, I'm not going to lie about that. But how most of the characters are, or the characters are isolated to their setting, if that makes sense, or at least there is no one in the Monogatari series that doesn't need to be there. Most of the sets or the setting is empty, besides the character's presence and the odd 3D car, which is also part of the aesthetic. This gives us an almost plain stage for analyzing and examining Araragi as he moves forward and how he interacts with others. We get to see humanity, or humankind, or human nature even, in its almost purest form, as not necessarily purest, because that would imply a lot of things, but we get to see it in a very isolated manner, and I think that just gives us a better way into looking into a character like him. And that's because the human condition is almost, or human nature is almost always influenced by people. Our understanding of human nature comes from the influence of others, and how humans act and react is usually always relative, or it's a response to the world around it and the people that construct it. So having very minimal influence, I think, is a very rare look into a character versus another series. And it's not to say that, oh yeah, other series are doing it wrong, but other series like to show the dynamic between people and this, and how this affects human nature. Great example, my favorite anime right now, Evangelion, does that from almost the beginning. It's the influence and social pressures which change how Shinji really views the world and how he tries to mold towards it, but also rejects it at times. And the Monogatari series kind of does the opposite. Just to quickly roll back and talk about this idea of hedonism and pleasure, I would say that we see this in the final film, and this is kind of where we start to talk about all of the films as opposed to just Taketsu, which is actually my favorite. But anyway, Taketsu and the interactions with Hanekawa kind of turn from the first film, it's very kind of subdued, even though there is the sort of kickstart into it being the iconic shot of Hanekawa's quote-unquote areas. And then by the final film, we get very close up to this. And this, am I necessarily backing it? Not particularly. But I am just trying to say that Araragi's inappropriateness kind of brings out this raw hedonist, primitive hedonist. And that is kind of what we start to question what humanity is, because these are these two very raw forms. But then we compare him to Shinobu, who does almost a similar thing. She has, or delves quite a lot into short-term pleasure, when we think of her as a vampire and feeding off blood, as well as by the time we get to the third film, and Araragi is horrified by her actions. But the thing is Araragi very different? And that's the question we really have to think about. Hasn't Araragi basically come to the same place and kind of met the same ends as Shinobu, even though he did it through a different means? Unintentionally, he has, I don't want to say outgrown his humanity, but he definitely has it in a very blurry position. Basically, on the plot level, I know I did speak a bit about animation, but on the narrative level alone, there are a lot of things we can point out and a lot of small things I can sort of cherry pick about Isin's writing that suggest that they are pandering to this idea of humanity and questioning or putting the human condition into perspective. But there is also the aesthetic element of this too, which I did kind of start to get onto, but let's talk about it a bit more. These things which Oishi and Co do, Oishi Shimbo and its students, and all the other notable animators as well, everyone from Naoki Kobayashi to Kenichiro Abe, the list goes on. All of these staff manage to really tap into this idea of humanity through the aesthetic choices, alongside this narrative thread which is already managing to build it up. These ideas of desire, but also this romantic feeling, and I kind of mean that more in the context of romanticism, but these are still things which I'm researching. So surrealism and postmodernism and how these factor into what Kizu Monogatari and the, alongside also the influences of the French New Wave too, which is a crucial part of the series, which I really want to, I need to actually watch some New Wave film in order to get in touch with it a bit more, which I should be doing in hopefully the upcoming weeks, if not months. But still, I think there are things we can extract which communicate the aesthetic and also communicate this subtext of humanity, even without understanding a lot of the influences which come from the various filmmakers and also just various other movements as well within art. A lot of Oishu's choices when it comes to the color palette, so this very warm color palette which basically washes over the entire film, it's like a blanket thing over the trilogy. Kind of reminds me of this sort of never-ending sunset in the media, as well as just generally sunsets and warm colors are associated with good things, and also the sunset just has a very prestigious idea to it. I don't know whether it relates to like the power of nature, like sublimity or something like that, but it's very well respected, and Oishi manages to employ that throughout the entire film, as if we have this constantly never-ending happiness, but that is obviously contrast. A big thing to point out is also just what these warm colors imply. I know I kind of did mention that, but just backtracking a bit. Our association with warm colors is often desire and heat and love and passion. These things which come not just from sunsets, but our ideas of just what warm things are. Warm things pander to attachment, or we relate a lot to attachment and human warmth, as well as just physical warmth too. Another side thing that isn't particularly related to humanity, but it's also just how we can tell who Oishi is as a filmmaker through employing this thing. And yes, there is night and day and weather within the Monogatari series, but when we consider that a lot of it does take place with this orange tint, which affects the grade of almost every shot within it. Yeah, really, it just shows his disregard for chronology, and I guess that just shows what sort of film style he taps into, being close to the postmodern approach to filmmaking, really, where chronology is fluid and it's really used as a means for what you want to portray, as opposed to having to follow it and adhere to it to the T, because that isn't really its purpose. The purpose of time is to morph it to fit your purpose, because it is all constructed. The same goes with the choice of skin tones as well, and I hopefully, if I remember, and I'm saying this in the podcast, or I remember when I'm editing to actually put it in, there is a wave motion, or there are various wave motion canon resources which I recommend for looking into the Kizu Monogatari series, and a lot of these things I am sort of subconsciously remembering now from that interview, or the various interviews from Oishi. There are also stuff on the wiki, but those are taken from wave motion canon as well. A lot of extensive discussion about these choices, so I do recommend, beyond just this podcast, if you are listening and are interested within Kizu Monogatari, to check out those Wave Motion Canon interviews, and they should be in the show notes on getinthemecha.home.blog. But back to the actual episode itself. This choice of pinky skin tones, and it is with the intention of displaying that there is blood within these characters, as blood is a big theme within this series. It's the exchange of blood is what keeps these two characters, Araragi and Shinobu, together and connected. But also it does tap into, even though that is its primary goal as an aesthetic decision, I think it still does connect back to this idea of warmth and desire, and just really that underbelly, or the underbelly of the trilogy really seems to be desire and fear coming together, these two very primitive emotions or feelings which make us up and makes up Araragi. And it is still enshrined within its aesthetic from many perspectives, so it's very difficult to get away from. I know I did also say that I am still researching postmodernism and surrealism, and I am, that is the truth. But if we do think about these two ideas, and I don't delve too into them because I think that should probably be either its own episode by itself or something we just speak about a bit more in detail at another time. But just if you just take what I'm saying, like with a pinch of salt, when we think about postmodernism and surrealism, two very important things which influence the Monogatari series and its approach, we get to understand how the aesthetic does still enshrine this notion of humanity and allows to question the human condition. I would say this is through the combination of realist elements alongside the much more fitting, drawn and sort of embedded within fiction, saying quotes, elements as well. So the drawn backgrounds, and it's not to say that there are things which probably look real but aren't drawn, but there is an element of real life photography in there as well. Like when we look into the water looks awfully real. I'm kind of going to avoid saying hyper real, because it feels literally real. It feels like a video of water. We also get those Buddha statues as well within the opening sequence. I do believe they're Buddha statues, please correct me if I'm wrong. There's a layer of realism, but it's really what does the realism do, which I want to get to. And what that does is that it imposes humanity on an animated work. And I feel like that's really meta, because one must understand what we construct within our world and bring that within to an animated work, which we already understand is fiction. And so it's very self-aware. It's aware of its audience. And obviously, almost every... because we make film, we're aware of our world and we're aware of the world we're going to create. But it's always weird, regardless of the film, when we have something that breaks the fourth wall or at least shows elements of our world within it. Almost like when you watch the Amazing World of Gumball and you see the backgrounds are very made up of real life photography. It feels like it's kind of communicating with us in a way which a fully drawn background wouldn't really be able to do. Imposing realism and imposing our humanity really just brings the debate into a bit more perspective within its aesthetic. These elements of things which don't seem human, what we would consider not human, even if it is a human construct within Kizu Monogatari itself. So like the backgrounds which are actually drawn, the characters, yes, they are human, but do we perceive them as us and our humans? Not necessarily. But imposing realist elements onto a film which is fictional does bring out this debate a bit more and brings out this conflict a bit more. It makes it a bit more real. If I dare say. We can also say though that this battle between what is human and what isn't is taken a bit further as well within its editing, to this very disorderly editing one, which is also kind of disregards chronology and disregards sort of typical filmmaking standards or typical means of editing. The purpose of an edit in the context of realism is often to skip from one bit of time to another, which is after itself, and to have logical shot orders which make sense in accordance to not only like the eye, but what is easy for the viewer, unless one is trying to make effect. The point of it really is just not to, you know, zoom in, zoom out really quickly or cut in, cut out very fast. But because Kizu Monogatari does this, it breaks this realism as well. It breaks this documentary sort of style, which the series often does try to go for, but it's disorderly. It's broken down. And so how human does this really get? It is very limited. It's very hard to say it's one or the other, because it's constantly disrupted by another element. I do hope that actually makes sense. I know I kind of went through a lot of weird rabbit holes and shortcuts, but what I'm trying to say is that these contradictions that I kind of spoke about at the beginning are also prevalent within its aesthetic as well. From the editing in contrast to the elements of realism within the film, as well as if I just go all the way back as well, because I might as well do that. the other things like fear and desire. Also, Shinobu and Araragi, two very contrasting people. These things question the humanity of Araragi to begin with, and it isn't really a linear thing. It kind of is a linear thing, but it also isn't in how. We assume that the transformation is a linear process of, okay, slightly becoming less human now, or what we consider to be human. But then we eventually question, was he ever really, I don't say was he ever really human, but didn't he show signs of not being human, or what we would typically consider human to begin with, as he shared a lot of these, in quotes again, primitive traits, which Shinobu also shared, which he feared to begin with. I also did forget as well on the perspective of animation, I just wrote it in my notes and I kind of can't pass it up. Realism as well comes within animation too. I would say there's a much more animated look to someone like Yuya Geshi, who, as I said before, animates the train station scene and when Araragi's running with all the thick lines around him. That is a very different understanding of humanity and what a human really is relative to someone like Kou Yoshinari or Genichiro Abe, who animates fire in a very realistic way, and one which models how fire moves in the wind and in the air. It gives us a real sense that Araragi really is burning. And so the contrasts exist everywhere, and we can suggest that this anime from the very start, or at least this trilogy, brings in this debate of human nature from the get-go, basically. These films really managed to make the word humanity a really big area of contention, or it's a very debatable term that we are slowly exploring the more and more we dive into the film trilogy. What does it mean to be human to begin with? I've been very strong on imposing this on Araragi, but if we flip it over and look at Shinobu, it's weird how for a good time within the film, yes, she is half human, kind of, but if we are very binary about it and we put Araragi as human and Shinobu as vampire, it's the fact that we eventually just consider Shinobu a human for a second, or at least Araragi manages to acknowledge her as just a human. He puts her in his human body. And I think it just goes to show that potentially this is something which is performative and not necessarily something which we are innately, we can grow out of it as Shinobu manages to do, since, as I said, Araragi puts her in the sort of human category for a while when we get that lovely scene of young Shinobu just running through the flowers and is all cute and everything. And then Araragi comes back to the place and then he sees that she literally devoured someone to the head. And so that just dissipates afterwards. So humanity, I think, is performative. That is a bit of a, at least in the context of the film, applying this to real life is difficult, as I don't know how much we can compare ourselves to other beings too, but this is something I think the film just really pushes really hard on us. Is humanity simply a name? And I think so. I also think we apply emotions very exclusively to human. Some traits are human while others aren't. These primitive desires and pleasures alongside these primitive fears aren't human enough, and it resembles something which we can't put our fingers on. I've managed to realize this for myself from not only watching this film trilogy, but having the pleasure to analyze it also in this, or from this perspective. And I think we do need to maybe get out of the mindset of displaying or analyzing binaries as basic. Having two sides, having a quote-unquote good and bad side, is to some awfully unnuanced and just really lazy writing, I say in quotation marks. I completely disagree in the context of Kizumonogatari, and this is something we really need to take case by case, because these binaries can work awfully well, and being able to switch that fast works in the context of Kizumonogatari because of the emotions we're dealing with. We're dealing with with two very separate parts of the human or of human nature, and having that nuance doesn't really capture how simple we are as people, really. I think Kizu really manages to abandon this idea that humanity is complicated and full of different elements to us. I would say the Monogatari series generally doesn't really explore this as much, but at least in the context of Kizu, there's a lot of proof to show that maybe we are all that feral monster that we all try to shut out or suggest that we aren't, and I think Shinobu manages to get Araragi to realize that. Koyomi Araragi becomes the feral monster he never thought he would become, or the one which he always shut out, even though some of these traits existed within him before he even met Shinobu. And Shinobu, who in the train station has this will to live and has this very infant look to us, she cries on the floor and screams for her life, just becomes the destructive monster that we assumed she was afterwards. Or that's a bit biased because we know Shinobu already by the time we are heading into Kizu Monogatari, at least if you watched in release order. But it's these very sharp shifts towards these different personalities, you can call them, or at least very different natures, shows how it's kind of already prevalent within them already. Araragi had this, the switch is what really needed the flipping. And so I kind of come to a conclusion to suggest that, and I do want to ask a few more questions about human nature and the human condition before we finish. But I kind of conclude that Kizu's main attempt is just to show that humanity is simply a facade. It's a temporary performative state that we class ourselves as, since we have the privilege of calling ourselves humans. But it takes a lot more to be a quote-unquote human from the behavioral side of things. It takes, it's a way of acting, it's a way of conducting ourselves, and when we come out of that, we really become something which we're very afraid of. And one last thing before we kind of enter our end game of this podcast, I think this all does boil down to this postmodern, you can call it, approach that Oishi has, that everything is a construct. And I feel like that just comes through this trilogy in and out all the time, that everything is made, everything is constructed intentionally. And the same applies to humanity and who we are. It's all in the hands of a person who decided to create this, but also it's all a construct. It's all myth, and it can really be perceived in any way we want. The core of the Monogatari series is this thing on apparitions and how we as people have problems within us, and these manifest into apparitions, and this is the thing which underpins basically all of the show. It's the main thing is dealing with these apparitions which exist within people and within these girls. But I think Kizu Monogatari is a very good way of reframing this idea that it isn't particularly the apparition that is the problem per se, but the apparition is only a manifestation of what already exists within us. And so we all return back, or everything returns back to the human condition and who we are, and how we, in the case of the human condition, how we emote, how we feel and understand the world, that is where these things come from. We are, one can suggest that we're influenced by other things, but we are also the cause of how we feel, as basic as that sounds. It kind of ends up being this chicken and the egg situation as to which one came first, the negative emotion that bred within someone, or the thing that caused the negative emotion. And I think it does end up being the former, that it's within us and that only manifests into something worse. And so to kind of end this, because I know this is going for too long, and as some of my podcasts go, we start off talking about a film or an anime, and then it eventually just turns into a debate of human nature and what is the nature of the world. And as much as I would love to chat philosophy and things from my perspective, this is an anime and manga podcast, so I don't want to go too far into that. And so I'll just end by saying that Kizu Monogatari is a conflict conflicted piece of work. And this is often framed as a criticism, but I mean this in the highest compliment possible. These are three of my favorite films for a reason, and it is very justifiable in how it's a conflicted piece because of how its approach to filmmaking, its aesthetic, its writing, everything. It's an attempt to blur the lines between humanity, not just for Araragi, but for us also. Understanding humanity is very different to me now, and I'm not really suggesting that Kizumonogatari is going to change your life and also change your perspective of what humanity is, but it's funny how this question is being posed to us humans too through another example. Our understanding of the fabric of the Monogatari series, which is humanity and humans who drive this narrative, is the very thing in question here. And that is why I love this series. It's because it's always challenging things. It's always challenging the convention and the norm, whether that's again in filmmaking, whether that is within its themes, and challenging the very human condition itself and trying to reframe it for us. The Monogatari series is insanely ambitious and also massively contradictory. With all of that, this was a very long-winded episode, but I can finally say that it is over, and that is the analysis for this week. I hope you did enjoy this one. It is a bit weird kind of jumping into a series without maybe an arc analysis, but the arc analyses will follow very soon. Like, I have them very ready to roll out. When I say very ready, I don't mean recorded, but I at least have the thumbnails and have some ideas on what I will be discussing in those episodes, so keep out for that. Keep an eye out for that. Also, be sure to follow on Twitter if you want to see the progress I'm getting up to. I do often talk about podcast stuff. I also talk about animation and that all the time. But that hopefully will be in your podcast feeds very soon. And now let's get to the moment of the hour. Okay, not that, but let's get to the In The Moment segment. And I'm kind of going to talk about something which I've been reading this week. If you are new to the In The Moment segment, do not fear. It's a very simple segment. I just talk about what I've been reading or watching for like 5 minutes or so. So it's not too long, but it will give you a bit of a dose, or at least a bit of a dive into what I'm getting up to, besides just pumping out long analyses about humanity within Kizumonogatari. And so in today's episode, I will be, or at least within this segment, yes, I am going to say that I have been reading One Piece, as you probably already know if you've been listening for a while. One Piece, I am on, I forgot the exact number, but I am in the 500s. I am in the, and I don't want to expand too much, but I am in the Impel Down arc, and things are going well. But the focus of this In The Moment segment isn't really to talk about One Piece itself, but it's really how I've been reading One Piece. And more about manga itself, because I have, as you probably already know, I've been reading One Piece physically, or at least now you know I have. I have read One Piece physically from the beginning up to volume 51, which I can see right in front of me in my bookshelf, and that is all the way to Thriller Bark and about half of Sabawadi Archipelago. And that is in numbers about half of One Piece when this is being recorded, because I'm sure there'll be someone listening to this in the future and One Piece 1000 is already out. And so eventually this won't become halfway. I'm sure as One Piece grows and as this podcast grows, this will only be like, I don't know, 1/3 of all of One Piece or something. But as of now, this is about halfway into the narrative. And I've actually now decided, I'm still in the 500s, but I'm like before 550. I'm like 530 something or 540 something. And I've decided now to finally start reading digitally. This is a switch I was kind of reluctant to make. If we exclude stuff like cost, I would say One Piece is quite good value for money, considering because it is one of the more popular, if not the most popular, Shonen Jump manga at the moment, and in of all time, basically. That means that we get to we get 3-in-1 Shonen Jump volumes, and so that makes things really good, because you can pretty much get 3 volumes for the price of almost one, or like 1.25. And so it's very good value for money, and we get it for a few of the other series as well. I don't know if every country has them, which is why I'm kind of describing them a bit more. We have them for Naruto as well. We have them for I'm very unsure if we have them for Bleach, but I know we have them for Naruto, and I'm pretty sure we have them for Dragon Ball as well, and Dragon Ball Z. So it's more the popular pieces which have them, and I wish others did employ that strat as well, but I get it, economics, money, and yeah, One Piece is in demand, and so why not get people to read it in 3-in-1? And so I bought those up to volume 51, but now I've actually made the switch to digital, and it's very different, but I also really like it now. But besides cost, the thing which really motivated me was because it was just much easier to read. And I love physical manga, but the struggle is, as someone that often reads manga in bed, it is very hard, or even when eating, it's very hard to either hold it with one hand onto a table and flick the pages. And it's also very hard, as someone that reads manga a lot in bed, to hold it up. And because of how my lighting setup is, it's just so difficult, and it's a pain to read. My arms end up aching by the time I finish reading for about 10 minutes because I'm just holding it upwards from my bed. So that really sucks. And now I have a tablet, I could just read it flat on the table, or I can just put it under my blanket and read from there. So it does make the manga reading experience better to some degree, at least for my own physical health. But from the perspective of enjoyment, I think there's value in both. I really do love though about reading One Piece digitally is how I can zoom in. I can zoom into spreads, and I'd even say the spreads are easier to read now. Just because, one, yes, I can zoom in, but one thing which really annoys me is how, because of how it's made, and I like the original print, I enjoy it. When I say original print, I just mean the traditional style with the floppy pages and the spine and how that is. I like that, but the difficulty is actually seeing some of the spreads, and you end up losing some within the middle too. So it is its own experience, but at the same time, it is rather counterintuitive sometimes. And so I'm kind of learning that for myself as I get more into manga again, as I actually have a lot of momentum now. I've been reading manga almost every day, versus I have like a few series or some manhwa which I just read a few days at night, and I'm starting to realize these things and learn these things for myself. But that is like my manga rant over, and it wasn't really a rant, I don't know about that. Hopefully next week or something I'll be able to say I've been actually watching something, as I am coming to the end of Lulaco, which is very short, but I don't know how I haven't finished it. Maybe I'll try to finish Aizukun or It Invaded or something, give some final thoughts on it. But yeah, that is the segment. Let's go to closing thoughts and kind of just give my very summarized version of the cinema of humanity. Yeah, and Kizumonogatari. I know the cinema of humanity isn't like a legitimate thing. I made that up because it sounded cool and it kind of sounded smart. So I wanted to put that as the name of this episode, Kizumonogatari, the cinema of humanity. But it's actually very applicable. And Kizumonogatari's main aim for me, as I've described throughout this episode, is to really pin down what the human condition is and really reframe that. It gives us a better insight into human nature and really what we really are. These binaries, as uncomplex as they sound, is also an attempt to really show us that humanity isn't very complicated, or as complicated and nuanced as we think we are. Kizu argues basically that we are constructed of fear and pleasure, and these two things come together in very extreme circumstances. We can kind of, from this and a lot of more reasoning, suggest that humanity is performative, and it's something, it's a role that we take on, and we categorize it with various other emotions. But it, when we put that into the perspective of Kizumonogatari, it's, the question really is, are we as human as we think we are, as we have these, what we can call feral or primitive elements which lie within us? And Kizu's also what Kizu tries to do is really just reconfirm that this isn't only because of an apparition or a monster, to really drill it within us, that it kind of already is there to begin with. Additionally, the aesthetic of the Monogatari series, and specifically the Kizumonogatari series, has this conflict embedded within it as well. Everything from the imposition of realism to how it's edited, and even the various staff which feature on it. From the beginning, it has been constructed to question human nature, and I think it does this very well. Thank you for listening to another episode of Guest in the Mecha. That has been episode 68, Kizumonogatari and the Cinema of Humanity. I'm honestly very tired of saying the word Kizumonogatari. Like, you wouldn't imagine how, even though I'm very used to it now, it's a very quick word, like Kizumonogatari, Kizumonogatari, but it still takes very long to say, and so imagine saying that about 100 times in a podcast. But it has been a fun episode. This has been like the most recent episodes I've really enjoyed recording. I think I've kind of taken some, I want to say, risks with some of the content lately, and there is more Monogatari series to come. I'm very excited to start this chapter of the podcast and actually talk about something that is something which we haven't spoken about yet, and yet it is one of my favorite series. And so I really also want to carry on this trend of talking about new things as well. Obviously, Evangelion content will always be a thing here. I'm not planning to stop that. I have some things I have in the back and ready to whip out soon. But thank you for listening to the episode, and if you did enjoy it and made it this far, it would be lovely if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. There will be, I like to throw a link on Twitter every now and again if you do want to get that, but also if you are already on Apple Podcasts, if you're listening on iPhone and you're on Apple Podcasts already, it would be like lovely if you're right there on the app to leave a review. Just go to the ratings and reviews section, leave a review, leave some stars as well, and tell me honestly what you think of the podcast. However, all fun things have to come to an end, and this podcast has come to an end. So I will hopefully see you next week on episode 69, which, spoilers, won't be an ecchi episode, and I'm not even being sarcastic. But that has been it. I have been your host, Jamal, today. Have a good one, and this has been Guest in the Mecha.
The music in this production goes as follows: 8-bit title screen by Joth, Mandatory Overtime by Joth, and Difference by Chasers Gaming.